Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are wrestling with a subject that feels pretty immediate and honestly often overwhelming: inflation.
Yeah, it's everywhere in the headlines.
Exactly. So we're looking beyond all that noise to Martha Olney's really essential analysis: inflation. What it is, why it's bad, and how to fix it.
And this is, I think, a really critical deep dive for you, the listener, because, you know, inflation is constantly generating headlines, but it's often wrapped up in, like, economic jargon or partisan argument.
Totally. It's confusing.
Right. So our mission here is to kind of move past the sound bites and give you a clear, nonpartisan framework. The idea is, by the end of our chat, you should feel more confident evaluating economic news, understanding what's really going on.
Yeah, getting beyond just feeling anxious when prices go up, right, to understanding the difficult trade-offs policymakers are facing only really pulls back the curtain on who inflation helps, who it harms, and why getting it under control is such a delicate balancing act.
It really is. So before we jump into the mechanics, maybe let's talk about our guide here, Martha Olney.
Good idea. Who is she?
She's a teaching professor of economics at UC Berkeley. And interestingly, a highly decorated educator, she's won teaching awards. Her background is in macroeconomic history.
And that teaching professor title feels really important, doesn't it?
It absolutely is.
Because unlike maybe some academic economists who write mainly for other academics, her whole expertise seems focused on the art of making these dense, complex ideas accessible, you know, for students and just regular curious people.
Precisely. She's not out there trying to prove some brand new theory. Her goal is more about empowering you with the tools to understand the established principles. It's very pedagogical.
Meaning she wants to teach.
Exactly. To make sure the discussion is clear, grounded in solid theory, but also, crucially, free from the political spin that usually clouds this topic. She's an educator first, and that makes the book feel like a genuine user's manual for anyone curious about the economy.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. The absolute foundation. Because I think a lot of us, myself included sometimes, confuse inflation with just, you know, seeing high prices at the gas station or the grocery store. What is inflation really?
Yeah, that's a common mix-up. Olney is super precise here. Inflation isn't just a one-off price spike for, like, eggs or gas.
Right.
It's a sustained increase in the overall average price level of pretty much everything, goods and services. And the crucial consequence, the thing that really matters, is the decline in the purchasing power of money.
Ah, so your dollar just buys less stuff over time.
Exactly. That erosion of value, that's the real pain point of inflation.
That distinction feels so important to get right up front. And speaking of terms, can we quickly clarify the difference between inflation rising prices and those other words we hear thrown around? Like disinflation and deflation.
Yeah, definitely. Good idea. So inflation is when that rate of price increase is positive. Prices are going up.
Yep.
Disinflation, that means the rate of increase is slowing down. So prices are still rising, but just not as fast as they were before. Maybe it goes from 6% inflation down to 3%. That slowdown is disinflation.
Still rising, just slower. Yeah. And deflation.
Deflation is when the average price level is actually falling. Negative inflation, basically.
Which sounds great, right? Cheaper stuff.
Yeah.
But only points out it can actually be much more dangerous for the economy as a whole.
Oh, absolutely. She uses examples like Japan's lost decades. When prices are falling, people tend to delay big purchases. Why buy today if it'll be cheaper tomorrow? But when everyone does that, spending grinds to a halt. Businesses don't invest, they don't hire, and you end up with deep economic stagnation. So yeah, inflation is bad, but deflation can be this really catastrophic trap.
Wow. Okay. So if inflation is fundamentally about losing purchasing power, how do economists actually, like, measure that loss? We hear about the CPI all the time.
Yeah.
The Consumer Price Index.
Right, the CPI.
It's the official number, but man, it often doesn't seem to match my own grocery bill or, you know, what I feel like I'm spending.
And Olney helps explain exactly why that gap exists between the official number and your personal experience. The CPI works by tracking the cost of a specific fixed market basket of goods and services, stuff a typical urban household buys.
Okay, a fixed basket.
Yeah, but because it's fixed, that measurement method introduces some, let's call them limitations or biases.
Okay, biases. Yeah. What are the main ones she talks about? The ones that make the CPI maybe not a perfect reflection of reality?
Well, there are a few, but two big ones she highlights are, first, substitution bias.
Substitution, meaning?
Meaning, If the price of beef suddenly spikes, most people don't just keep buying the same amount of expensive beef, right? They switch. They substitute chicken, maybe, or pork.
Sure, yeah.
But the CPI's fixed basket is slow to catch up with that switch. So it might keep tracking the higher beef price, making the official inflation rate look a bit higher than what people are actually experiencing because they've already adjusted their habits.
Okay. That makes sense. And the second bias?
The second one is the quality change bias. This one's tricky. Think about phones. A new smartphone costs way more than an old cell phone did years ago.
Right.
But is that purely inflation? Or is it because the new phone is vastly, vastly better? It does so much more. The CPI tries to account for these quality improvements, but it's really hard to do perfectly.
Yeah.
So sometimes it might overestimate inflation because it's not fully capturing the value jump from better quality.
Gotcha. So the measurement itself is complex and has these built-in issues.
Yeah.
Okay. So we know what it is, kind of how it's measured. Now, the really big one, what causes it? We hear politicians constantly pointing fingers, it's too much government spending. No, it's greedy corporations.
Yep.
Only pushes back against that simple blame game,
right? Oh, strongly. She argues that blaming just one single thing is probably the biggest mistake people make when analyzing inflation. She breaks the causes down into three interconnected forces.
Okay, three forces.
The first is demand pull inflation. This is the classic idea you might have heard. Too much money chasing too few goods.
Right.
It happens when total spending in the economy, what economists call aggregate demand, outpaces the economy's ability to actually produce stuff, aggregate supply.
And lots of things can fuel that extra demand, yeah. Like low interest rates making borrowing cheap, people feeling confident in spending more, or big bursts of government spending.
Absolutely. All of those can push demand up. So that's demand pull. The second force is cost push inflation. This one starts on the supply side of the economy.
Okay, different origin.
Totally different. It's driven by sudden negative shocks to supply. Think about things like geopolitical crises disrupting oil supplies like the OPEC embargo in the 70s, or natural disasters, or major global supply chain breakdowns, which we saw post-COVID.
Yeah, definitely saw that.
When the cost of essential inputs like oil or energy or computer chips suddenly jumps, producers often have little choice but to pass those higher costs onto consumers in the form of higher prices.
Okay, so demand pull from too much spending, cost push from supply shocks. Mm-hmm. Is it usually just one or the other driving inflation? Or can it be, you know, more complicated?
Well, Olney's point is that the really severe, stubborn inflationary periods, think the 1970s or the recent surge after the pandemic, they were usually caused by a kind of perfect storm, a messy combination where both demand was strong and supply chains were broken, both happening at once.
Oh, the perfect storm. That sounds bad.
It is. And that complexity often feeds into this really dangerous feedback loop she talks about, the wage price spiral.
Right. I've heard of that. That's where, like, prices go up, so workers demand higher wages to keep up.
Exactly.
And then businesses raise prices again to cover those higher labor costs, and it just goes round and round, pushing everything higher.
You got it. And all of this, the demand, the supply shocks, the wage price spiral, it leads into her third critical driver, which is maybe the most interesting, expectations.
Expectations. How does what we think cause inflation?
It's fascinating. Basically, what businesses and people expect inflation to be in the future becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh, how does that work?
Well, if businesses expect inflation to be, say, 5% next year, they're likely to raise their prices by about 5% today to get ahead of it. And workers expecting higher prices will demand wage increases of at least 5% just to keep pace.
So expectations drive actual behavior that creates the inflation everyone expected.
Precisely. And this is why Olney emphasizes that the credibility of the central bank, like the Federal Reserve in the U.S., is probably their single most valuable asset.
Credibility, meaning people have to trust them.
Yeah. If the public and businesses trust the central bank to do what it takes to keep inflation low and stable, to keep expectations anchored, as economists say, then the psychological battle is largely won. People won't bake high inflation into their plans.
Wow. Okay. That psychology part is huge. Let's make this really concrete for people listening. If inflation is running hot, who actually, you know, wins from that and who loses? Because she says it's definitely not neutral.
No, not at all. She calls it a powerful redistributive force. There are clear losers.
Like who?
Well, savers get hurt badly. The cash they've tucked away loses real value unless the interest rate they're earning is higher than the inflation rate, which often isn't the case.
Right, the value just shrinks.
And people on fixed incomes think many retirees living off pensions or Social Security that doesn't adjust quickly. They also see their ability to buy things just erode rapidly.
And that ties into another really key theme from the book you mentioned earlier, the difference between real and nominal values.
Yes. This is maybe the most practical takeaway for everyday life. Think about getting a raise. You get a 5% raise, that's your nominal gain, the number on paper.
Feels good.
Right. But if inflation is running at 7%, that 5% raise means you've actually taken a 2% pay cut in terms of what you can actually buy with your money. Your real wage went down.
Ouch. Okay.
So only stresses we always need to think in terms of the inflation adjusted or real value, whether it's wages, savings, investments, debt. What matters is the real value.
Okay, so savers and people on fixed incomes are typically losers. Who are the maybe quiet winners when inflation is high?
Well, the primary winners are often borrowers who have fixed rate loans, especially big long-term ones like mortgages.
How did that work?
Think about it. They borrowed a large sum of money when dollars were worth more. Now, they're paying back that fixed amount over many years using future dollars that have been cheapened by inflation. They're repaying the debt with less valuable money. It's a huge benefit.
Okay. So debtors with fixed rates win. Anyone else?
Owners of real assets often do well too. Things like real estate, commodities like gold or oil. Their nominal value tends to rise with inflation, acting as a sort of hedge against losing purchasing power.
So it sounds like inflation really can worsen inequality then, hurting people relying on cash or fixed incomes while benefiting those with debt and assets.
That's often the case, yes. It disproportionately tends to hurt the poor and the elderly who are less likely to hold those kinds of inflation-hedged assets or fixed-rate debt.
Okay, that leads us right into policy. If we agree this redistribution hurts a lot of people, why is stopping inflation or controlling it so hard? What tools do policymakers actually have?
Olney lays out the two main toolkits. The first, and usually the main one used, is monetary policy. It is handled by the central bank.
Like the Fed.
Like the Fed in the U.S., exactly. And their primary weapon is adjusting interest rates.
Raising rates, usually, to fight inflation.
Typically, yes. By raising interest rates, they make borrowing more expensive for everyone, for businesses wanting to invest, for people wanting to buy homes or cars. The goal is to cool down spending, to reduce that aggregate demand across the whole economy.
Does it work?
It generally does, but Olney points out is a very blunt instrument. It affects the entire economy, not just specific sectors. And crucially, it works with a significant time lag. The effects of a rate hike today might not be fully felt for months, even a year or more.
Okay, so monetary policy is one lever. What's the other?
The other is fiscal policy. This is what the government controls its spending levels and taxation.
So Congress and the president, basically.
Right. To fight inflation using fiscal policy, the government would need to do contractionary things, either cut its own spending or raise taxes. Both actions would, in theory, reduce overall demand in the economy.
In theory. Huh. But does that happen often?
Well, as Olney notes, using fiscal policy this way is often really slow, politically very difficult. Nobody likes spending cuts or tax hikes, and it gets bogged down in politics. That makes the central bank's monetary policy, while blunt, usually much more agile in practice for managing inflation cycles.
Right. And this brings us smack into the middle of the central dilemma, the big trade-off in fighting inflation, doesn't it? Something called the Phillips curve.
Exactly. The Phillips curve basically represents this painful choice that policymakers often face, at least in the short run.
What's the choice?
The choice is that policies designed to bring inflation down, especially raising interest rates sharply to cool demand, often have the unwanted side effect of slowing down overall economic growth. And that slowdown can lead to higher unemployment.
Ah, so fight inflation, potentially lose jobs, let jobs boom, potentially let inflation run hot.
That's the classic trade-off. They're often forced to choose between the goals of stable prices and full employment. It's not an easy balance.
Which really underscores one of her powerful themes you mentioned. Policy involves trade-offs. There's rarely a perfect solution. Policymakers aren't being malicious. They're often stuck choosing the least bad option available.
Absolutely. And a main core theme that really resonated, I think, is that complexity is the norm. If you hear someone on TV giving a really simple, single-cause answer for inflation, just blame the Fed, or just blame government spending, or just blame corporations, Olney's work shows they're almost certainly missing the bigger picture.
Because it's usually a mix of things.
Almost always. It's the interplay of demand factors, supply factors, and, as we discussed, that crucial element of human psychology and expectations. Simple answers are usually wrong here.
Okay, let's maybe circle back to some of the core ideas from the book that really stick out, kind of like memorable quotes or key takeaways. Olney really defines the stakes well when she argues.
Yeah, this one's great. Inflation is fundamentally not about prices going up, but about the value of your money going down. Just reframing it that way, focusing on the erosion of your purchasing power, that feels like the most useful lens to look through.
I agree. And how about the one that pushes back against the blame game, the simple demand versus supply debate?
Right, she says. Asking whether inflation is caused by too much spending or broken supply chains is a false choice. The most severe inflationary episodes were caused by a perfect storm where both were happening at once. That really challenges those oversimplified narratives we hear all the time.
It does. And finally, that point about trust in psychology.
Yes. The battle against inflation is fought as much in the minds of the public as it is in the boardrooms of the central bank. Central bank credibility is indispensable. It's such a good reminder that economics isn't just about numbers. It's deeply rooted in human behavior and trust.
So powerful. Okay, let's bring it home for everyone listening. What are the key real-life applications? How can understanding Olney's framework actually help you right now?
Well, in your personal finances, just understanding that real versus nominal value concept is huge. It completely changes how you might think about saving versus investing or even taking on debt.
How so?
It makes it clear why just holding a lot of cash in a high inflation environment is basically a guaranteed way to lose purchasing power. And conversely, it shows how using low fixed rate debt like a mortgage can actually act as a shield because you're paying it back with cheaper dollars later on.
That's a big shift in thinking for some people. What about at work?
Yeah, in your career, this knowledge is gold for salary negotiation. Instead of just asking for a raise, you can use your understanding of real wages to argue for compensation adjustments specifically tied to inflation, maybe referencing the CPI or another index. You're making the case to maintain your actual purchasing power, not just get a nominal bump that gets eaten away.
That's really practical advice.
And I think the ultimate application really is becoming a more informed citizen. This book basically acts as a filter against misinformation and political spin. When you hear on the news that the Fed raised interest rates again,
Yeah.
You don't just hear noise. You now understand precisely why they likely did it, probably to cool down demand. And you also understand the potential, often painful, side effects they're anticipating, like slower economic growth, maybe some job losses. You can see the difficult trade-offs they're navigating.
It moves you from being confused or anxious to being analytical.
Exactly. You understand the tough choices involved.
You know, what really stands out to me the most from our discussion and from Olney's approach is her use of history. Especially when she digs into the great inflation of the 1970s.
Oh, yeah. That's a key part of the book.
Because that period really showed everything we've talked about in action. The demand pull, the cost push oil shocks, the unanchored expectations, the painful policy responses. It vividly demonstrates the huge social cost of letting high inflation get baked in and just how difficult and complex the road back to stability can be.
It's a powerful case study. For me, I think the final thought, the biggest takeaway, is that this kind of economic literacy, understanding these core concepts, only explains so clearly. It's just pure empowerment.
Empowerment how?
By getting a handle on inflation's mechanics, we stop being just, you know, passive recipients of scary headlines that make us anxious. Instead, we become more confident, more critical analysts of our own financial lives and of the policy decisions that shape our world. That knowledge, I think, really changes everything in how you engage with the news and your finances.
Well said. It equips you to ask better questions and make more informed decisions.
Exactly.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.